They're more like the people that one sees in Dante Gabriel Rossetti's Victorian paintings than they are ancient saga heroes of God. Nonetheless, the point was, if you remember, that the literature of a heroic age is never produced by that age itself, but by a succeeding age which is already looking back upon it in a nostalgic and a giant way. And here it does seem to be, perhaps this is what Mr. Sherman means, and Who Goes with Fergus, short as it is, though it has the pre-Raphaelite colouring and nostalgic, trailing, mournful rhythms to it, this is controlled, as it isn't in The Hosting of the Sea. And I think within its very modest compass, yes, this is a great poem. Do you remember it's the poem that crops up in the very first pages of The Choice of Ulysses? And this is an evidence, a sort of evidence which you shouldn't overlook. The intelligent and sceptical young Irishman of the time accepted this poem as part of the furniture of their minds. They quoted it at each other and to each other, which is one sort of evidence that you've got a good and thoroughly accomplished poem. Yes. Well, Mr. Sherman will cast his vote then. Can I have someone else? The Hoolan's Fight with the Sea, which is pages 8 to 11. That's fine. Would it be unfair to ask you why you like it or what you particularly like about it? If it were...
There's something about the economy of it.
I think that's perfectly correct. This is an attempt at the starkly heroic, and I think that the points that Mrs. Cuff makes are absolutely right. Stark, bleak, elliptical. Particularly so if you compare it with a famous, let's apologize, Victorian poem, which Yeats Thomas certainly had in mind when he wrote it. What would that be? That's my boy. Matthew Arnold's Sohrab and Rustum, which is the deliberately epic poem on a Persian plot, but the plot is precisely the same, in which the old warrior is challenged by one who, though he doesn't know it is his own son, kills his son, then realizes what he's done. And of course, this plot, we are now sophisticated enough, I should think, to realize that there's no, that it's quite interesting that this plot should crop up in literatures as wide apart as those of ancient Ireland and ancient Iraq. Plainly, it is related to the Oedipal situation. Just as there are many poems about the son who kills the father and feels guilty, this is, as it were, a mirror image of that. The father who... there's another one. At any rate, I think it is a genuine advance upon Arnold. It's a very intelligent retelling of the story. Because Arnold's poem is a remarkable poem. I mean, it is one of the remarkable pieces of Victorian heroic writing, Victorian attempt at epic. And Arnold was very serious about it and very intelligent. He knew what he was doing too. I think it would be proper to say that are... Well, perhaps I'll put this into the form of a question. Where do you think Yeats got the idea of telling a story so largely in dialogue? And thereby telling it very, very obliquely and cryptically indeed. What other poems in English? Well, yes. But it's very interesting, it really is very interesting. I mean, it is an extra evidence of the fact that this plot is not just a picturesque story. It crops up in all these different cultures because it is treating symbolically and in fable of some of the most difficult and intimate problems that we go through with. That is to say, what is the relationship between the father and the son, the mother and the daughter, the basic kinship situation which modern psychology treats of in its own way, and which in the hands of Freud he treats of it in terms of these, in precisely the terms which the old fables and mythologies had used. I had in mind, actually, speaking of dialogue, the border balance of like Maud Randall, ballads mostly from the Anglo-Scottish border, taken down for the first time, mostly in the 16th century, but going back much, much older, stories and ballads, which of course many of them have analogues also in this country. They were part of the folk furniture that the early colonists brought with them, and they could still be dug out in places like the Appalachians, or Arkansas, where communities have relatively little changed over the centuries of living in Ireland. An interesting thing about this poem, incidentally, I have mentioned that Yeats never knew even a smattering of Gaelic, though despite Douglas Hyde and a whole generation of Anglo-Irishmen who were applying themselves to that, there is in fact evidence of this. For instance, in a passage which is not in dialogue, one of the brief narrative passages, the bottom of page 9, starting again, going over the page, among those feasting men Cuchulainn dwelt, and his young sweetheart close beside him knelt, stared on the mournful wonder of his eyes, even as spring upon the ancient skies, and pondered on the glory of his days, and all around the harp string told his praise, and Conchobar, the red branch king of kings, with his own fingers touched the brazen strings. In fact, I think I am right in saying that what I have there pronounced Conchobar, which is what you would naturally say in English, and moreover it's what the metre requires. But in fact this is, I think, the old Irish form of Conor, so that anyone who knew Irish would realise that despite appearances it is not a trisyllabic name, but only a disyllabic one, which would throw the metre every which way. The same thing occurs, you see, when Conor shows up again on the last line on page 11. Again, you have to say every time, Conchobar.
Wait, you said that Conchobar and Conor?
That it would be...
Cuchulainn was not... Cuchulainn was not in Conor. Cuchulainn was in the Ulster.
Yeah, Conor. Yes, but Conor is not the name, not as the name of a place, but as the name of the High King of Ulster.
Conor.
King. And Cuchulainn, one of his great heroes. The relationship is something like that between Agamemnon and Achilles, say, in the Iliad. The leader, the most power greatest of his warriors, Cahulain, is, of course, as it were, only nominally under command and control of, well, the king. Yes, I think it is. I think this is a remarkable poem, and one that we are right to admire. Also, it is a situation which Yeats was to return to. Cahulain's Fight of the Sea is here among his earliest poems, but it's also in later plays and poems right up to the end of his life. It was an emblematic situation. For instance, the last line, which I think is very beautiful, and fought with the invulnerable tide, where the invulnerable is beautifully placed, both in its meaning and in its rhythm. Well, you can begin to see how that can be, by the later Yeats, used in quite different ways. The tide, he speaks of democracy as the foul tide of the world, the impossibility for the solitary man to fight and defeat a thing so formless and multitudinous as the sea, can become Parnell resisting proudly, but of course hopelessly, the formless, multitudinous, and irresistible, alas, from Yeats's point of view, force of the populace, the people, the mass, the mob. So that he comes back many times. Right? Another poem that someone much admired? Yes. Yes, well, this is indeed a famous riddle puzzle poem. And we can't embark upon it now. I think, again, I'll anticipate, I think that this, too, is a puzzle. We must understand that, yes, Yeats is a great poet, but we're now seeing him in his early years. And there's a great deal more to be said about that. He's always a serious poet. But there is a sense in which some of these early poems are more obscure than any that he's going to write out to him, simply because he hasn't really got control. He can do certain things, he's got a style that can do certain things, and he tries to make it do other things. And this we can locate quite precisely. We could have done it in, I thought we'd done enough with To Ireland in the Coming Times. But if you look at the syntax, you try to work out what the grammar of certain sentences are, and I think you'll find the same about the two trees. Well, we'll look at it tomorrow. I don't want to spend too much time on it.
No,
Let me just, before you go, say that there's one poem that I do think is very beautiful, and there's more than one, but one, and I'm surprised nobody has come up again, is Adam's Curse on pages 28-29. Now that is a difficult poem. The difficulty is not in competence. It's one of the earliest poems that I would say, plainly a poem of a great and original poet. So I'd like you to look at that too before tomorrow. And unless I am very much prevailed upon, this will be the last session that we shall give to them. I want to move on to the later and more important middle collections next week. On Monday we celebrate the birthday of a gentleman who had the good fortune to be born a subject of King George and ended his days in a less happy condition. So we meet next on Tuesday. And I would hope that with this extended weekend you might in fact have read the bulk of that prose which I asked you to read. Prose by Yeats mostly, some by Singh, and if you can get to it by George Moore, which goes along with the early poems that we've been looking at and are still looking at today. We have some unfinished business. Yesterday we were talking about... excuse me. Yesterday we were talking about the habit, Yeats's habit of revision, and we had a particular example of it in the two versions of To Ireland in the Coming Times. I have checked briefly, and I must report that the editors of the Norfolk Polity do not deserve the reproof that is given. That is to say, it's really quite interesting. They do date quite exactly which of the many variant printings they have followed, and they are the early printings, so that it is really, those of you who have access to the Norton, it is really quite interesting to compare the version which Mr. Sherman read, which is the original version, or nearly, and the version that we have, which is the last version. For a full treatment, you have to use this Variorum edition, which in fact will give you the entire history of the changes through Yeats's life. And I'll have the Variorum put on reserve over the weekend. The Variorum edition is a very complicated matter, as you can imagine, and if you're interested in this at all, you can only follow through one poet in this way. If we were to follow every one of the poems in this way, we'd get ourselves totally lost. The other book which I recommended, which deals with this in a selective but useful way, is Thomas Parkinson's W.B. Yeats Self-Critic. Which is available in paper, in fact, it's lately been reprinted. Let me recommend particularly Parkinson's analysis over many pages of the little poem called The Sorrow of Love, pages 13 and 14. It's only 12 lines long. It's dated as 1892. It is, in fact, very misleading. Okay, that's when the first draft of this poem appeared and was first published. Yeats worked at it, changed virtually every word in the 12 lines over a period of many years until the final version, which is the version you have there, in fact, was one he arrived at in 1925. And this is particularly interesting because, whereas yesterday we were looking at some poems which are suffered from revision, we didn't give To Ireland in the Coming Times a sort of exhaustive examination which would allow us to be certain about this, but so far as we went, I was suggesting to you the process of late revision, the process of pushing the ideas and vocabulary of the mature man into a fabric which is basically that of the immature young man, in fact produced an unsatisfactory double focus and muddle. This does happen. It doesn't happen all the time. There are certain poems which he consistently improved, and I think this one that I'm now drawing your attention to is a case in point, The Sorrow of Love, and you will find several pages, really quite fascinating pages, of Parkinson's book about this, tracing it. It is extraordinarily illuminating to see. And really chastening, I think, to see how endlessly self-critical a poet like Yeats is, how he still remains dissatisfied, how more than 30 years later he is still not quite satisfied, knows he's improved his grip, there's still something wrong. It's quite extraordinary. Now, the other unfinished business is one that we were asked specifically about the poem The Two Trees. And indeed, we must look at that. This is on pages, tell me somebody.
17.
Thank you. Page 17. This, fortunately, is not one of the early poems. which was extensively revised, so that the text that we have is, in this case, substantially the same as the original one. So the date 1892 is, in this case, not misleading. This is an important poem. I think, I'm going to suggest, not a good one, but an important one. And there's no wonder that... who was it? This, we'll draw our attention to this. That isn't here. That people found it obscure. It is obscure in the same way as we've looked at these poems about the red rose, the rose on the root of time, and have spoken about the Rosicrucian mysteries and the occult tradition of Rosicrucianism. So, the two trees comes out of another occult tradition, which is related to the Rosicrucian, but is basically different, the Kabbalist. From the Kabbalah. Now, these traditions exist. It would be possible, I would think it eccentric, but it would be entirely possible, as it were, to lead a class into Yeats's poetry, not in the way I have done, through the history of Ireland, but through tracing the Rosicrucian, the capitalist, and some other occult traditions. This isn't the way that I've chosen to do it. That work is certainly there for anybody who is interested in doing it. And if people like to come to me in office hours, I can give anybody who's interested certain leads as to reading which follow these up. At any rate, it is true that the two trees is barely understandable without some, at any rate, general knowledge of the symbolism of these two trees in the Kabbalist tradition. It takes off basically, of course, from the tree in the Garden of Eden, the tree which bore the forbidden fruit, which Eve, against the explicit injunction of the Creator, plucked and ate at the suggestion of the serpent, and which he then gave to Adam, hence the fall from grace. But there is a very special twist given to this in the Kabbalist tradition. I'll read the poem, and then I'll read the pages, or some of the pages, that in fact Tom Parkinson does give to this poem. The two trees. Beloved, gaze in thine own heart. The holy tree is growing there. From joy the holy branches start, and all the trembling flowers they bear. The changing colours of its fruit have dowered the stars with merry light. The surety of its hidden root has planted quiet in the night. The shaking of its leafy head has given the waves their melody, and made my lips and music wed, murmuring a wizard song for thee. There the loves a circle go, the flaming circle of our days, guiling, spiring to and fro in those great ignorant leafy ways. Remembering all that shaken hair and how the winged sandals dart, thine eyes grow full of tender care. Beloved, gaze in thine own heart. Gaze no more in the bitter glass the demons with their subtle guile lift up before us when they pass, or only gaze a little while. For there a fatal image grows that the stormy night recedes, roots half hidden under snows, broken boughs and blackened leaves. For all things turn to barrenness in the dim glass the demons hold, the glass of outer weariness made when God slept in times of old. There, through the broken branches go the ravens of unresting thought, flying, crying to and fro, cruel claw and hungry throat, or else they stand and sniff the wind and shake their ragged wings. Alas, thy tender eyes grow all unkind, gaze no more in the bitter glass. And this is what Tom Parkinson says. The two trees in which he employs the Kabbalistic trees of life and knowledge to express and inculcate his view of life and vindicate his poetics. In the two trees, the poet speaks to his beloved in direct address, counseling her to look into her heart, where the tree of life grows in joy, merriment, surety, and harmony. When she looks on that tree, when she ignores the world of nature and time, her eyes grow full of tender care. Hence, beloved, gaze in thine own heart. Therefore, he urges her to keep her eyes turned inward so that she may forget the demands of the temporal world. There is no good in the world of mere knowledge. There a fatal image grows, with broken boughs and blackened leaves and roots half hidden under snows, driven by a wind that ever grieves. When she looks on this tree of knowledge and on the world of intellectual discrimination, commercial bargaining and mutability, she partakes of its evil qualities, and her tender eyes are no longer solicitous but unkind. Gaze no more in the bitter glass. Both the bitter glass and the two trees are symbols derived from Yeats's studies in mystic thought. The trees from the Kabbalah, the glass or mirror from Jacob Burma. In his commentary on Blake's symbolic system, Yeats had occasion to analyze these particular symbols, and the meanings he ascribes to them in Blake's system are the very meanings he plays upon in the two trees. The bitter glass had once been the mirror of God, the exact reflector of his being, until men in the pride of individuation had asserted their identities in isolation from the mind of God. By insisting on the priority of human reason to imagination and the boundless life of the impersonal world, men had lost contact with the eternal, multiplied individuality, and had torn human life away from the divine. Quote from Yeats's. The early Yeats's commentary to Blake, the mirror was changed to that hard stepmother we call nature. The tree of knowledge, of reason, erudition, and argument is the tree appearing in that false mirror and is mistaken by Yeats's beloved for the tree of life, which can be perceived only in the human heart. The tree of life is the current of life when seeking God, and the tree of good and evil is the same current seeking the world. That's from Yeats's commentary to Blake again. Here, I'll break off and I'll take up Parkinson in a moment. We really here are in a quite complicated situation, which you may have already encountered if you have read those essays, the early essays in Ideas of Good and Evil, in particular the two essays there about Blake. Blake's symbolism and Blake's illustrations to Dante's Divine Comedy. At this point in his life, Yeats, like many students of Blake at that time and today, is still basically operating in terms of a stark antithesis between knowledge, computation, reason, intellect on the one hand, and on the other, a world which is by its nature less easily definable, but which is a world of feeling, of intuition, of impulse. I've already pointed out that by the time we get to the 1930s, when Yeats is in fact extolling Swift for intellect, that simple model is no longer serving Yeats' purpose. At that point, he is distinguishing inside the world of the intellect between that sort of human reason which characteristically goes for quantity, for calculation, for commercial transactions. This he dislikes still, but he now, in his later life, detaches from that altogether. Quite different, and as he now sees it, altogether more noble sort of intellectual operation, which he associates with Swift, which he also associates with the, in fact, abstracting, ultimately mathematical intellectual operations of the abstract artists of the modern movement and of ancient Byzantium. Thus, the two trees really are to be seen as a, or can most usefully be seen by us, as the early Yeats's response to William Blake, a response which, as he grew older, he had to refine and change to the point where it is hardly recognisable. That much, perhaps, some of you will, that far, perhaps some of you will want to go. You won't want to go into the Kabbalists or into Jacob Boehme, unless you're very much, you have special interest that way. But certainly those of you who are interested in Blake, as well as in Yeats, may be interested in this. You may want to consult, some of the books. There are books. I mean, there's a whole book called Blake and Yeats. And, in fact, consult the notes that Yeats contributed to, the early edition of selected Blake poetry, which he brought out in the 1890s, along with a collaborator called Edwin Ellis. That's a special interest, a special study. I mention it for those who are interested in it, or who want to get interested in it to the extent of doing a paper upon it. To go on with Parkinson about this poem, The Two Trees is one of the earliest poems in which Yeats treats the conflict between the active and contemplative life as it comes to a crisis in the life of a woman he cared for deeply. Now, this woman that he cared for deeply is, of course, we have met her already, the Irish revolutionary Maud Gonne. And there is little doubt that the woman he is addressing in this poem is Maud Gonne. Now, Maud Gonne was an active revolutionary leader at this time and throughout this time. Yeats was lost in a passion for her, which she did not return. She had a sort of affection for him, but she refused to commit herself passionately to him. And the poem, therefore, is effectively saying to her, stop this activity of agitation, organization, revolution, politics. And instead, well, do all the things that are spoken of in the first half of the poem. This, you will see, is the earliest manifestation that we've come across of Yeats's attitude to women, which, for instance, cropped up at a much later period in his life, when we'd seen the film and I read that poem about Lissadell. The light of evening, Lissadell, great windows open to the south, two girls in silk kimonos, both beautiful, one a gazelle. These were, you remember, the sisters Gore Booth, of whom one of them, Constance, married a Polish revolutionary, became Countess Markovitz, and became a principal heroine of the Irish Rising in 1916. And Yeats then goes on in the poem, you remember, to say, to speak wistfully of how he remembers her when she was a beautiful young woman of the gentry riding to harriers under Ben Bulbers. And although he doesn't quite say it explicitly there, he is really taking the same attitude to Con Markovitch in the 1930s, as he's already taking to Maud Gonne in the 1890s. He cannot get round, he cannot help but feel, in fact he gets more and more firm and assertive about this, that it is not a woman's place to be in public life an agitating and organising revolutionary. Particularly not, of course, from here you can sympathise with him, when he's desperately in love with her. Simply Maud Gonne hadn't got enough time for him. So the origin of this attitude towards woman, which in the vulgar jargon of today we must call, I suppose, sexist, in fact derives ultimately from this protracted agony which he did go through with Maud Gonne. And this is what the human meaning behind The Two Trees, which seems to be such an abstract poem. It is in fact related to a quite specific and indeed agonizing human situation. I want, before we're through today, to go on to look at Adam's curse, which is also about Lord God, which I think is a much, much more powerful poem, written 10 years later. One reason why it is more powerful is that there, he doesn't abstract it into a generalized statement using, after all, arcane symbolism, but actually puts it in the form of a relationship in which they speak to each other, and of each other. Parkinson says, well, that passage is now, what Parkinson says is good. He picks up some of the poems in between the two trees and the Lycidel poem, which deal with the same thing. Notably, a very beautiful poem, which we shall spend a great deal of time on, A Prayer for My Daughter, in which he really speaks of Lord God and... perhaps I will read this. Of the many later poems that suggest the depth of Yeats's implication in the life of this woman who, I say Lord God, who bartered, as he said, plenty's horn for the angry wind of political debate and violent action, this passage from A Prayer for My Daughter, 1919, is a good specimen. Have I not seen the loveliest woman born out of the mouth of plenty's horn, because of her opinionated mind, barter that horn and every good by quiet natures understood for an old bellows full of angry wind? What he says about Morgan in 1919. Parkinson comments, the angry tone of speech and the clear statement of the problem show that even 25 or more years later, the experience was so important to Yeats that it was a source of pain. In her autobiography, Maud Gonne gives a more prosaic account of the problem. And she says, I never indulged in self-analysis and often used to get impatient with Willie Yeats, who, like all writers, was terribly introspective and tried to make me so. I have no time to think of myself, I told him, which was literally true. Parkinson comments, a paraphrase of The Two Trees, from Miss Gonne's point of view, could well read, Willie Yeats was terribly introspective and tried to make me so. That's what he is doing. He's saying, please be introspective more. Please forget about at least some of the time. And in order to make this point, he dredges up the two trees of the capitalist tradition, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life, and asks her to identify herself with the tree of life and not with the other. And this, as I've suggested already, and as Parkinson suggests too, is a counterproductive thing to do. The points were to be made much, much more forcefully, much, much more poignantly, and in much more forceful and vivid and memorable language, when instead of hiding it all behind a cloudy symbolism, he, in fact, put his point specifically in the form of a specific human relationship, as in Adam's curse first, as in Prayer for My Daughter, when he is speaking down specifically towards the little girl child that has just been born to, as in Lycidel, where he speaks to the Gorbu sisters. Hence, poetically, this, I think, is though it's an interesting poem, because what it says, poetically, in any strict sense, stylistically, it's a very poor poem. Parkinson says, rightly, I think, the basic vocabulary of the poem, exclusive of the occult symbols, is not in any important way distinct from that of other poets of the 90s, Lionel Johnson or Arthur Symons. The language is at a great remove from the colloquial. In other words, a long, long way from anything that we can imagine ourselves or Yeats or anybody saying. For instance, the shaking of its leafy head has given the waves their melody and made my lips and music wed, murmuring a wizard song for thee, which is almost worthy of a Christmas postcard. It is true that the syntax is free of inversions. Parkinson makes this point too. In other words, although the vocabulary is bad, if fact, the grammar is here running fairly clearly. And the subject, verb, object of his sentences do tend to come up in the same way in which they would come up in considered speech or in prose writing. This is quite important because this is one of the things that the young Ezra found recognised in the young Yeats and most wanted to emulate. So that there is a movement towards clarification and towards the colloquial, away from poetical diction, and it's there in fact in the structure of the sentences, not really in the vocabulary. Particularly interesting, I haven't checked, but I suspect that it came in a later revision, is the word guiring, six lines from the bottom of the first section of The Two Trees. Guiring, spiring to and fro in those great ignorant, leafy ways. Now, the gyre is going to be one of Yeats's crucial words. It both has a noun and as a verb, to gyre, a gyre. It is to be found in the Oxford English Dictionary, but it's a rare word, and until Yeats used it, an archaic one. It is obviously related to words that are perfectly common and normal usage, like gyrate and gyration. It comes to have considerable meaning. It is the technical word, I think we could say technical, for a rising spiral, such as particularly the falcon makes when it is released from the wrist of the falconer, unhooded and cast off, and the falcon then climbs as fast as it can by a climbing spiral. And this is, strictly speaking, a gyre, therefore. A circling and mounting movement at once. And in some of Yeats's most elaborate both poems and prose of his mid-period, that gyring is going to take on an enormous significance. He is going to espouse a philosophy of history. We've seen some of it already in the passages about Vico in that preface to The Words Upon the Window Pane. A cyclical view of history, such as indeed Vico and others through the centuries have held. Not a simple return of history, but a circling and moving movement, a circling and moving pattern. And some of the most elaborate passages of Yeats are going to use the word gyre in this sense. This is the earliest appearance of it in his writing, to the best of my knowledge, and though we need to check the very on to make sure I'm prepared to... No, I'm not prepared to bet, but I very much guess that, in fact, this was brought into this poem in some revision between 1892 and his death in 1939, or the publication of his collected poems, which is the text this man is copying. Now, that much time, isn't it? I was going to go on to Adam's Curse, and I'm prepared to do so, but since this is perhaps the last session that we shall formally give to these pages, if anybody would prefer to talk about another poem, or to raise a point about another poem, I'd be glad. You've read Adam's Curse, for instance. Is there anything about it which you found puzzling or worthy of remark? The curse of Adam, of course, which was imposed upon him according to the Christian mythology when he disobeyed in the garden and was cast out of the Garden of Eden, is, as the scripture says, thou shalt labour through thy days with the sweat of thy brow. Adam's curse is the curse of work. This is not addressed to... Well, it is addressed to Maud Gonne, but tells her, whether this really happened or not, doesn't matter. The incident is quite clearly and begins, "Dear Maud, the other day, I and your close friend, woman friend, were talking about you, and the conversation went like this. We sat together at one summer's end, that beautiful, mild woman, your close friend, and you and I, there were three of them, and you and I, and talked of poetry. I said, a line will take us hours, maybe, yet if it does not seem a moment's thought, our stitching and unstitching has been naught. Better go down upon your marrow bones and scrub a kitchen pavement or break stones like an old pauper in all kinds of weather. For to articulate sweet sounds together is to work harder than all these, and yet be thought an idler by the noisy set of bankers, schoolmasters, and clergymen, the martyrs call the world. The curse of work, and Yeats says, and the hardest work of all is writing poems. This is continually borne out by all the evidence that we have. Yeats worked at his poems much harder than most poets do, or than it is, I think we dare to say, that it is normal for a poet to have to do. He himself spoke of it at a later stage as this unnatural labour.